been looking forward to this for a little while. So yeah.
Me too. Yeah, I can't wait. It's going to be great. Right, let's go straight into the cliche opening. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Breaking Point podcast. Today, we are here with Thomas Throssell. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, perfect. Bang on.
Perfect. Cool. And as you can tell, he's not from the UK. He's from Australia. Whereabouts in Australia are you from, Thomas?
Western Australia, in Perth.
I don't actually know much about Thomas other than that he's a very, very original thinker and we're going to have a great conversation. So I'll let you give the viewers a bit of an introduction to yourself and how you got to where you are today, age 22, is it?
Yeah. So my name's Thomas. I run the Thinking Over Project, which is a social media-based initiative tackling mental health, but in a different way to it. Especially what I see in Australia, we have a very fixed sort of diagnosis pattern for mental health, which is that we are good at identifying systems and promoting conversations and talking about it and raising awareness. But when it comes to the back end in terms of treatment, we have a few limited options. I know that's common for most of the Western world is psychotherapy and antidepressants is our main go-to remedies when it comes to mental health issues. And so I think that there's a lot of information out there right now saying that things like exercise, alternative therapies, even just sharing the load amongst, you know, close friends and close family is probably more of the battle than we actually think right now. And so I want to spread a message that encourages people to start playing a bigger role. And that's been something that's driven from my life. I have five brothers, obviously mum and dad. And I think the hardest part for me growing up was realizing that, you know, five of those eight family members in my household have struggled with mental health issues at some point or another. And to realize how close it actually hit to home once I was able to start thinking about these things was a real eye-opener that it's not just, especially growing up with brothers, you know, surrounded by boys the whole time. I went to an all-boys school. You don't really tuck into these issues too much. And so to realize how much it affects your day-to-day living, it was really eye-opening for me, especially growing up.
Were you one of the five or not?
So I'm number five. There's one below me. That's it. So I was fortunate enough to observe this from the outside. So three of my brothers had a clinical diagnosis of depression, and then obviously mum and dad had dealt with their own demons. And so it was very interesting to be so close to people coping with or suffering from these issues, but never actually experiencing that myself. So it's been, yeah, close to home for me.
Yeah, definitely. You can see that. Yeah. Why do you think you didn't have less of a sort of proclivity towards suffering? Or do you think it was just you were gifted with the ability to observe them and therefore not be impacted by it?
It's been something I've pondered quite a lot because obviously, you know, there's been a lot of research into whether depression is genetic and the role that biology plays. And obviously your environment is a large part. And having a relatively similar upbringing, it is sort of unexplained why it happened to half of my brothers and not the other half. But looking back, if there's one thing I can point to, it's obviously with six boys, you do compete for attention at certain times and with a father that's trying to earn a living that can provide for all of them, you have to work to get your face in. And I was fortunate enough at from the ages of about 7 to 13 to my relay team at Little Athletics when I was younger, my dad was the coach. And so for about 4 or 5 years of those formative stages of my childhood, I was getting a lot of face time with the father figure, and who was very encouraging, very uplifting. We were very successful. And so it was easy to get that positive reinforcement from him, and it might have detracted from my brother's abilities to get that FaceTime as well. And that's the only key factor I could really draw back on and look at and go, yep, that's a point of difference between my upbringing and theirs. And so I've often wondered if it was that developmental FaceTime with my strong father figure role model that helped me develop some sort of stability all the way to adulthood.
Yeah. And also knowing that you're talented at something and you have something during those years to get your teeth into and work on. And it's a a sort of a good guiding force towards a preparation for life, isn't it? This morning I went through all your videos as much as I possibly could, which is all of them. Did you make a video about? No, it wasn't you. Never mind. So, yes, your personal Instagram, you look like quite a bit of an all-rounder. You're quite one of those sort of aspirational, but sort of in an annoying way sense. You know, you're good, obviously very athletically gifted. So I guess you, what am I saying with that? Where am I trying to go with that? You, growing up, things, did you say things came easy for you a little bit growing up, and then that allowed you room to observe what was going on around you and see people's struggling, or have I got that wrong? Were you good at school?
I was gifted with, speed on the track, and I could memorize things pretty well at school, which always gave me a good leg up. And so academics and sport was, two nice things that I didn't have to really worry about. And it allows you to sort of develop an identity with confidence behind it. And definitely, I look back on even just my years in high school, I was blissfully ignorant about how easy I had it going through those formative years because, my grades are never in question. I was never being under pressure from my parents to study harder. I was encouraged to go and train and keep competing, and Mum would come to every race of mine. And so it was a very supported, very protected childhood, I suppose, where I was just encouraged and loved. And I think it's from that lens that I'm able to identify so clearly what life looks like for people who didn't have that necessarily. And it is quite confronting how many people didn't have that reinforcement from both parents or from a loving family.
Yeah, a lot of society nowadays is privileges and disadvantages thrown around, and having loving parents is a privilege that isn't spoken about enough, is it? Having two or even having one loving parent is a privilege that I think almost outweighs all of the privileges that we talk about nowadays as being very, helpful. So, and that's really good that you're able to use that and with your own natural aptitudes to think about things and observe. And now you're doing the Overthinking Project, and which is a great name, by the way. Thinking Over Project. That's the point. Thinking Over, because it's overthinking. You've done a lot on social media and the studies around social media. What drew you towards, obviously everyone uses social media, but was there a thing that took you towards studying the impact of social media? Did something happen, or was it just curiosity?
I think even just in my own life, how debilitating social media can be when left unchecked. It's one of my brothers has a habit of ringing you out of the blue. If you've been sending him a couple of videos on Instagram, he'll just ring you out of the blue and start yelling at you, wake up, wake up, wake up. It's a little joke of his, but it's a really harsh reminder that you're just almost zombified when you're scrolling through these constantly reassuring, colorful, video hits that we just didn't consume content like that 20, 30 years ago. And I think I have pondered a lot what life looked like without such a massive suck of time going into what could essentially be reduced to meaningless activity. I think that there's some beautiful purposes to social media, and I've discussed a lot of them. And I think that it's a high leverage tool that we can use to communicate and connect and share a message, like right now, and to advertise products that might be life-saving or life-changing. There's the positives go on and on and on. But like every tool, I think one analogy I used was it's like a nail gun. Like, it's a very effective tool, but if you use it in the wrong way, it can be extremely dangerous. It's a very crude analogy, but as soon as you let social media wield your attention rather than you wield social media for your use, it becomes one of the most detrimental things to our mental health. I think, obviously, correlation doesn't imply causation, but it does not take a genius to realize that these two things that we're seeing, this social media epidemic and this mental health crisis, are almost perfectly correlated. And it's because we're, for the first time in our lives, existing in a virtual world, and we just don't really understand the risks that that entails. And I'm sure that you've probably experienced in your own life just social media sucking you away more than you had liked to when you jumped on it in the first place.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I'd be lying if I said that every time I put a reel up or something, I wasn't looking at how many likes it got. Or, and obviously you've got a far larger following than me, so I can imagine that it's, that's something that we all have to contend with. And I did a podcast that I put up yesterday that was literally about that, and especially the power that being a young, attractive woman can have on social media and how much attention you can garner as a result of that. Because I actually don't think there's anything more valuable than feminine beauty. As much as the feminists want to talk about male privilege, I actually don't think that. I think feminine beauty is at the top of the pinnacle of society or evolution or whatever you want to call it. So that goes against their ideas, but unfortunately it's obviously exploited as well. Going back to the social media, it's weird, isn't it? Because it's not only that we're engaging in something that isn't real, but I also feel it's, we live so much of our lives now through the lens of social media. And I think that subconsciously has an impact on us as well, because we sort of know that it's not real. It's like a fallacy. It's airy. I don't know what the word is. It's ephemeral, I guess. It's not tangible. And that can, engaging in that too much can be a detriment, because we lose our capacity to be grounded in, you know, reality and things that actually matter.
I posted a video a while back. It's probably the first one I would consider went somewhat viral. And the comments, I think it got about 1,200 comments. And it was a video with a sort of a rational argument against taking your own life. And I had posed the question that if you had approached someone who was suicidal or had suicidal tendencies, trying to give them the age-old advice of, like, think of everything you got to live for, is useless when they can't rationally draw on anything that's worth living for. Disappointing other people is not worth it, because obviously their health and their safety is their priority first above all else. And the rational argument that if I commit suicide, then my pain will cease, which is not illogical. It's just a very bad conclusion to come to, because everything else will cease. Every other experience will cease. I'd instead ask the question, what's one more day? Because, you know, the greatest memories I have, the best friends I have, the best opportunities I've taken, we all have taken, are the ones that we didn't see coming. It's not like we ever planned that day to go out and meet our best friend, and 10 years later we found, you know, we're exactly where we thought we would be. We just happened to end up there. And so the advice for me lent on the idea that it was simply a mindset shift. And I think a lot of, because obviously mental illness and mental health can be conflated sometimes, mental illness being these diagnosed debilitating conditions that can spread from neurobiological all the way to, you know, emotional driven states, to mental wellness or mental health is oftentimes, you know, our mood, and we can think ourselves into very bad situations. So I think mindset plays a big role in it. And it was almost 50-50 in the comment section of people saying, this is brilliant advice, I haven't heard this before, this is, you know, like life-changing for me. And the rest was dominated by people saying, it's been 30 years of one more day, so I don't want another single one. And I understand that there's probably no extent to the amount of pain that these people have collectively shared over the duration of their lifetimes. But the sad thing, I suppose, for me, knowing what I know, is that as long as you commit to the reality that tomorrow will be another terrible day, just like the last 30 years have been, I can guarantee tomorrow will be another terrible day, because you are, I don't believe in manifesting, but I believe in, you know, setting overarching standards and then subconsciously drawing yourself towards them. And so if you tell yourself that at the start of the day, despite whatever challenges I might face, I will make the most out of today, you can turn a very bad day into something that taught you a lot. But if you declare at the start of the day, today will just be another day of the same old shit, pardon my French, it's 99% chance. It's very unlikely that something good will happen to you that will convince you otherwise because you've declared that at the beginning of the day. And so I think that I was taken aback by how lost a lot of people feel that they can't even open themselves to the possibility that tomorrow has something better to offer them. I mean, at the end of the day, if your life has been 10 years of pain, the history says there's probably a good chance that tomorrow won't be fantastic as well, because that's simply what your track record states. But it's in the hope that tomorrow can be better that all, you know, meaning is found. And I think it's profound how many people haven't had enough good things happen to them to be reminded of what that hope feels like. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. There's as you said, you touched on, there's even if a million people spent every day for the rest of their lives contemplating how much suffering takes place in the world, it still wouldn't be enough. You still wouldn't be able to comprehend just how much suffering. So there's no lack of suffering in the world. That's definitely apparent. And that is very true. The people that are living in a fog can't see any way out whatsoever. And, you know, what's very common with depression and suicidality is you see the world through the dark lens, you know, dark tinted glasses. Mm. And you look back on your past and say, my past has been nothing but bad. My present is nothing but bad. And my future is going to be nothing but bad either. Mm. And then, you know, you really are paralyzed at that point. And also, you know, the cherry on top is everyone else will be better off without me. And that sort of that whole schema of thinking is just such a debilitating one. But I would say that if truth comes into it, and I know that you've not only a fan of, but you've met Jordan Peterson,
yeah,
which is definitely something we can talk about. And telling the truth, and there's a book, I'm not sure if it's come out in Australia, but it's big and not really big, but it's kind of, it was a bit well known. It had a 5 minutes of fame called I think it's The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse, or something along those lines. And it's like, if you don't know where to go, it says something along the lines of, if you don't know where to go next, or if you don't know how to get to where you want to go, but you know what the next step is, take that next step.
Mm.
And that's the key to taking the next step. And that was it. I wrote a note down about this. You know, they say it's easier to connect the dots backwards.
Never heard that before.
Than it is forwards. You've heard, you know, Steve Jobs said something like, it's easier to connect the dots backwards. Because you know how people talk about, you know, synchronicity, and
yep.
And I do believe in all that. But if you're going to be clinical about it, you can say, well, it's easier to look back and go, this happened, that caused this, and it caused that, it caused that. And I wrote something down whilst I was watching that video that you were just talking about. And I wrote, work to create a life where no matter how bad the dots look retrospectively, they led you to this moment and this life. So if you can, in other words, if you can work to a life where you're content and you feel happy, doesn't matter how bad the dots look, because they led you to this moment and this way of being, and therefore almost no matter how, and that's akin to what you just said about seeing every day as a possibility of a brighter day. And if, you know, the dots, you kind of understand what I mean? It was weird, but I just thought it's kind of related to what you just said.
Sure, yeah. I'm often taken back. I have a strong passion in 20th century history, and I'm particularly fascinated because I'd grown up thinking history was all numbers and dates and wars and battles and lives lost, such and such. Realizing that it's more about human psychology and human behavior, and I think the most brilliant part of history is it's really just posing the question, how did a population of people who probably would have existed and assimilated to our society today think so differently and so disturbingly in our lens when we look back on it? I think we're always gifted with the benefit of hindsight to look back at at the regular everyday life people in Nazi Germany, for example, who allowed such horrible things to happen. But if we were to take ourselves back, you know, 80, 90, 90 years now, and stick ourselves in that society, there's every chance we probably would have just seen a charismatic politician who was, you know, championing for our country to restore itself to its former glory. And we see messages like that today, of course, but I'm sure in 100 years' time, people will look back on the dots that we're making right now and laugh and say, how could they have been so short-sighted and foolish and not seen where their actions would lead? But it's 100%. With the benefit of hindsight that we can make such harsh judgments on people that are, for all intents and purposes, just as human as we are.
The Peterson does a really, his perception, conception of that is really interesting, the way he talks about, I think Carl Jung, do you know who Carl Jung is?
Yep.
Famous psychologist. You should, yeah, he's brilliant. He said the German people, Hitler became sort of a mouthpiece of the collective unconscious of the German people, which was the Germans had really been put through the miller as a result of the First World War, and they were really, really paying the price. Possibly unjustly, to be fair. And, you know, the powers that be were making an example out of them. And Hitler came along and he harnessed the resentment and the suffering that the German people held within their hearts and twisted it to his own advantage. Mm. And then, you know, step by step, progressively became more and more evil, or he was all progressively actualized his evil intentions more and more. And yes, so it's a common misconception is to think of the best place to look for evil is within ourselves, not within our own enemy.
Yep.
The first, at least, acknowledge, which is what Carl Jung talked about when he said, the shadow, and we need to integrate our shadow into our own psyche and become aware of the parts of us that are capable of doing the atrocities. And that's a really, really important thing. That's quite deep. Let's go a little bit. What's life like in Australia? I know you can't tell what the differences are, but how do you think Australia is going compared to America, which is clearly falling apart, and the UK, which is probably in its tracks, maybe picking up the dust that it's producing as it's running down this path? But what is Australia like in general, other than hot?
I think Australia likes to lag behind America by about 10 years, so I imagine we won't be far off, but it's not chaotic. I think a lot of the headlines I read or the news I hear about, I read with an element of thankfulness to be here. We have obviously the same sort of social issues and in different ways. And it's relatively peaceful. I think the beauty perhaps maybe just in the city that I live in, it's a large city. There's about, well, by Australian standards, about 2 million, 2.5 million people, but it feels very familiar and very everyone knows everyone kind of thing. And so there are a few community movements here that have done a fantastic job of giving young people in particular a place to go to connect and, you know, focus on human development and growth over what would, you know, generally be the partying scene in the Friday, Saturday, Sunday night, if you so dare, out on the town. I think that's a really good option that people my age have. It's very publicized on social media. There's a movement called Cold Nips where a bunch of not so sane people will get up at 5:30 every morning and go and have a swim. Then they go have a coffee and then have a chat. And it's a place you can go to dive into more meaningful connections than you ordinarily would. I think that you'd be pretty hard pressed to pick out a point. If someone asks you to go to a random city and find a place where you can just go and meet people who will give you a hug to greet you, not even a handshake, you'd be struggling to find something that comes to mind. But if you're ever in Perth, it's you know that Coldnips is the place to go. It might be a little bit chilly in the morning, but you'll be greeted with a hug, with smiles, with people who are genuinely interested in why you're here, what your passions are, and what you want to get out of this experience. In that regard, I feel very sheltered and very lucky to be in this part of the world. I don't know if it's so welcoming in other parts of Australia. I think that I always see the bigger the city that gets, the worse your mental health becomes, because it just cramps the style of living that humans are probably naturally intended for. You know, the more crowded your surroundings are, the more crowded your brain feels. Perth is very spread out. You can go down south in 2 hours, you'll be in lush forest. If you go up north in 2 hours, you'll be in red dirt. So it's a very different climate up and down the coast.
Yeah, and you're obviously by the sea as well. So you're by the sea, aren't you? Relatively.
Yeah. Very close.
Yeah. And that is, yeah, my Australian knowledge isn't great, but I know that I should know that, because the outback's in the middle and no one goes in the outback because you'd like dying because it's too hot. So everyone lives on the outskirts, roughly. Mm-hmm. But that is very true, I think. I wonder if there's a link between cities and societies that reside in more environmentally rich or naturally rich places, and their connection to maybe one another, or their connection to, well, obviously their connection to nature. But I wonder if there's a positive impact on mental health as a result of that. And then the more urban you go, the more gentrified and city-like a place becomes, the more of a number you become, and therefore that has a negative impact on your mental health. There could be a link between that. That would make sense, wouldn't it? Right. What else is there?
There's an interesting nature. That they postulate that nature is obviously very good for your mental health, and they're trying to work out why. And it was proposed that the varying depths of leaf structures and trees, and especially if you're in thick forest, how many different things you can focus on and attend to, it prevents your brain from dwelling on sort of not super important issues. And it was demonstrated that being out in nature was a great remedy for particularly anxiety, because obviously when humans are left to ruminate, the only thing to do is overthink. And so once you're in nature, it completely destroys your ability to try and process anything internal, because your brain is having such a jolly time processing so many varying bits of information in terms of the texture and the depth of the world around you, which is really interesting.
Exactly. And I think you mentioned this briefly earlier. You know who Nietzsche is? The philosopher Nietzsche?
Yeah.
Friedrich Nietzsche?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He said something like, some point he said, "We have killed God and we'll never find enough water to wash the blood off our hands." Mm-hmm. And he predicted, as you talked about the history, he predicted the atrocities that would take place in the 20th century, yes. How we would oscillate between authoritarian corruption, which is what happened in Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany. And then the other side would be a nihilistic sort of loss of meaning and purpose. And I think we're still suffering the consequences of killing God. And I think we're more and more, or at least the concept of God, we're burying him in the ground further and further. And I think it's having impacts on us in ways that we cannot comprehend. I think I thought this the other day, I actually think it's affected dating. I feel like that is applicable to dating as well. The concept of we've murdered God, you could say we've murdered what positive masculinity is, and in its wake has given birth to, I hate the term, genuine toxic masculinity. like someone like Andrew Tate doesn't rise to power unless there's some void and some lacking of recognition
and oppression or suppression that has been taking place, and he's been allowed to occupy that and rise up to an incredible point of power. And I think it's because we've killed God, or we've killed, I don't know, it's a weird one, but I just have to sort of get why I'm looking at it. The notion that Nietzsche said is applicable to lots of different things. What's your opinion on Andrew Tate? That's a good question.
I think I'm not a fan of at the end of the day, of the messages that he embodies. I don't think that male promiscuity, I don't think promiscuity in any domain is admirable or worthwhile. I don't think it's worthy of respect.
Yeah.
I think it's more respectful to have many options on the table and decide to choose one, because you can build something way bigger when you're only building one building than to try and build 10 at the same time. I think that the idea 100%. That material success and wealth can drown out internal pain and struggle is also misleading. It's probably the idea that if we can just work to be as rich as he is, it'll make our problems go away is misleading on one front, but I also do completely respect the work he's done in getting especially young men to simply be proactive and take action and take charge and decide that if they desire change to act in their lives, they have to be the ones to enact that change. I think that I'm never a proponent of writing someone off because I don't like a couple of things they say. I think that he probably says some very brash things, and if he didn't say those things, then he wouldn't offend so many people, but he also wouldn't reach as many. I think that he has a good core message, which is action creates change, and if you don't like your circumstances, don't look around to anyone else, but simply look within yourself and decide what can you change and make action from there. My favorite Andrew Tate quote, and excuse how crude it might sound, is that he looks at life as like a chessboard. All his pieces are gone. He's just got his king left, and he says, well, I'm fucked. What's the best move now? And it's the most rational way to look at your problems, because in the depth of a bad situation, all you can do is look at the pieces available to you. There is no point in crying about the fact that you lost the pieces that you used to have. I think that that won't bring them back, but he's done a very good job in reminding people that all there is what is in front of you, and that's what you have to use to get out of whatever situation you're in. In that regard, I think he's done a great job, and it's a similar core message to, you know, to what people like Peterson try to share, is action creates change. I think that adding, you know, politically divisive messages onto his persona has made him quite divisive, but that also may well be a ploy of marketing and virality that he's just done a very, very brilliant job at, because, you know, for people like that, all publicity is good publicity. And I don't think he is genuinely underthought the things he says. I think he's probably measured the consequences of what he is going to say. Yeah, I think he's probably been very, very particular, knowing that the messages would be divisive, but he's also taken into account how much more reach they will provide him if he is to say them. And so I think, you know, in some regard he's been very clever, but obviously he comes across as very crude and ill-informed to a lot of intellectual people.
Yeah. I think the biggest worry for me with Andrew Tate is, well, there's kind of two options. One is everything he says about the Matrix and all that, and him being cancelled and it's all lies, is true, in which case, well, we're a bit fucked because he's not an awful person who has clearly said some wrong things, but I think he's deliberately said some wrong things, and now he's backtracking because he's like, I just said them to get notoriety, but now I'm a bit like, oh shit. Or the other option is he's a narcissistic psychopath who has done all these awful things, and he's been allowed to get to the point of success, in which case we're also fucked, because it's, you know, but neither of those outcomes are good, really. But the one thing I worry about Andrew Tate is he started off doing drug dealing, allegedly, and also cam girling. And neither of those, particularly the cam girling thing, are conducive to promoting men's mental health. And now I think he's seen the pandemic of men's mental health crisis and thought, right, that's what I'm going to exploit to gain my following and attention. That's what I'm going to go for. He doesn't really care. He's just using that as a way of elevating himself up the hierarchy. So that is my biggest concern. But yeah, he's clearly a very intelligent guy and he's played the system very well.
Yeah.
And yes, I see a lack of
thought in his line that if he decides that his depression isn't real, then it's not real. I think that shows a lack of understanding of the truly debilitating effects of childhood trauma in particular, which is something I've seen play out in some of my close circles, is that it can't always just be thought away. There often has to be an external, you know, actor or force that helps to kickstart that process of rediscovery that sometimes just cannot be unentangled with a simple declaration that it no longer has control over you.
Yeah. So you're spot on. I think what he means when he says that is he won't accept it as a truity because therefore it can't affect him. He said when he got out of prison, he said, it's a good thing I don't believe depression exists because I would have been depressed in prison. And I think it's a dangerous message. But I think, I wonder if there's slightly more helpful undertones to it. Like when I was at university for a year, I read a paper on how they took two groups of people suffering from depression. And one group they told, yeah, sorry, you've got depression. It's a chemical imbalance. We'll give you some drugs to make you feel better, but there's possibly not too much we can do other than that. The other group, they said, yes, you've got depression, but you can change this, this, and this in your life, and you'll feel a lot better. And just the act of implementing or giving one group of people more power over their ability than the other had massive impacts, regardless of, it was all dependent upon their mindset and outlook. I'm not reducing depression to, I'm not saying that at all, but I'm saying that if there's a small or a possibly large extent to which your outlook and your actions, which you mentioned that earlier, how exercise and how mental health are being reduced now to medication and psychotherapy and all these other avenues are being ignored.
Yeah. I think I like to see it. The analogy I like to use is that you're driving somewhere and you're running late and you hit a series of red lights, five in a row. And by the time you get to where you're hoping to end up, all you know is that you're late, you're angry, and nothing else matters. And all it takes sometimes is a friend that you trust to sit down and say, hey, what happened? Okay, hit one red light, another red light, another red light. These are five separate events that can all be, you know, taken in stride. And on any other given day, there would be nothing more than a slight inconvenience, or maybe not even inconvenience, a chance to ponder something that's gone on in your day. But today, because stacked on top of each other, they were all led to you feeling like the world was against you. And sometimes what we consider to be a state of depression is simply just a conflation of five or six frustrating things that haven't been thought through in isolation. Obviously, that's not always the case, but I think that in this society where we're so encouraged to, you know, stay in our feelings and explore our feelings, often that leads to wallowing in our feelings, we forget to realize that there's some agency there and that some of the problems can be tackled. You may be able to tackle five out of the six, and maybe the sixth one needs a professional intervention or something of the sort, but you can probably alleviate a lot of the stress and pressure by simply laying out what the problems are, what can be done immediately in your control to help you break free from the pain that they cause, and then see what's left over, and then go again with some harder interventions. I think if we would have solved it like that, where it's, you know, peeling another layer off the onion and just tackling it each layer as it comes, we could probably reduce a lot of the severity or prevalence of what we would consider depression or anxiety. It wouldn't strip it all away because there are some more complex situations. But sometimes, especially in the last 10 years, people are encouraged more to perhaps overindulge in what they feel represents depression. And then once they attach themselves to that label, now there's not much that can be done because I'm now officially unwell. And if I'm unwell, then I need professional help. And it falls into this cycle of everything is now out of your hands because the problem is too complex because you didn't think it through in the first place.
Yeah. And 100%. And what am I trying to say? Yeah. So I think it's becoming more and more apparent now through studies and stuff that self-consciousness, this is something that also I learned from Peterson, which is brilliant, that there is no difference almost between being self-conscious and being anxious, or at least a strand of anxiety. So when people say, I'm feeling self-conscious, they basically mean I'm feeling anxious. And they're very, very, very tightly linked, not, 100%, but very almost somewhat indistinguishable from one another. And what that kind of says is that a great antidote to possibly anxiety and depression is engagement in something other than you. And, you know, my dad suffered from a lot of anxiety, as have I growing up. And apparently he saw someone who, this is back in the, I guess, 70s, early 70s, mid 70s. And they gave him a plastic band to put around his wrist. And they said, every time you think about yourself, pull the plastic band and let it go. And it will wake yourself out of your own thought pattern of thinking about yourself. Mm-hmm. And I didn't buy into that when he first told me. I thought, well, that's so selfish. How dare you say people that are anxious are thinking about themselves? And I thought, and I'm not saying that people with anxiety and depression are selfish, but I'm saying that you get into a vicious cycle and it just perpetuates it yourself more and more. You think about yourself and you get anxious, and then you get anxious and you think about yourself. And, you know, so, you know, when people say, how are you? A better question would be, what are you doing? What are you doing? Yeah. Or what have you been doing? That's a better question than how have you been? Because how have you been implies, how have you been feeling? And that's a, you know, that's a whimsical, up and down, fluctuating answer. But what you've been doing is maybe a better question. I don't know. But yeah. You talked about, I'm aware that we're 50 minutes in and maybe I haven't got that much longer, but you talked about childhood trauma within as much detail as possible. What do you mean when you say, because you have done a video on childhood trauma, haven't you? Something, childhood trauma is 10 times worse than adult trauma. What have you learnt / observed and experienced in that context?
Yeah, I have had the privilege, I would definitely call it a privilege, of being allowed to sit in on a couple of intense psychology sessions. I'm not sure if you're familiar with EMDR, but maybe for your listeners, EMDR is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is a fancy way of saying using movement of the eyes to mimic, you know, a certain stage of our sleep where a lot of subconscious processing occurs, allowing us to essentially re-experience certain traumatic moments, but without the same adrenal response. So we don't have epinephrine or adrenaline coursing through our veins, causing that fight or flight response at the same time as we're visually seeing the things that once traumatized us. And so I was able to witness that process happening live and be talked through it with the psychologist who was performing the intervention, and basically explaining that, you know, when you experience an acute trauma as an adult, let's say, you know, someone is sexually assaulted, I think it's a terrible thing, but the person who is sexually assaulted has a relatively good chance of being able to rationalize that after, you know, the help of professionals to say, I was not violated because of my worth, but simply because of the flaws of the human being who perpetrated that, you know, upon me. You're able to separate what happened to you from who you are. But the fascinating thing with childhood trauma is that before you sort of develop that concrete ego and sense of self, you are still adopting everything that happens to you as part of who you are. And so the idea that my parents smile around me, you know, ties into this strong sense of identity growing up, that, you know, you're lovable and that you're positive and you're smiling, you're happy, and you cause the people around you to, you know, laugh and be filled with joy. But alternatively, if you are violated as a child, when you have no ability to defend yourself, you can sometimes take that experience on as a reflection of what you must mean to the world. If I have been neglected by my parents and no one else cares enough to save me, well, that's because I'm a second-rate citizen. And once you assume that into your identity and then you grow up with that idea, you are now a teenager who is a second-rate citizen, because that's what I was when I was a kid, and therefore I don't deserve all the regular things that regular people do. And once you try to uncover that, you know, in therapy or with other interventions, it becomes a much harder process, because you're now having to disentangle parts of who you believe you are rather than trying to separate an event from who you already know that you are. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why crimes perpetrated towards children are so grievous, because it's an exploitation of people who just cannot defend themselves.
Yeah, that is, do you know about the sort of brainwave states and how our brainwave, the frequency of brainwaves changes as we grow up? So when we're between the ages of like 0 and 2, we're in like alpha or something, and then 2 to 5. I don't know exactly what it is, but there's a saying which is, show me the 7-year-old and I'll show you the man. And it basically means that up until the age of 7, we're like a sponge, and everything that happens to us, we process and absorb into our subconscious and our psyche with no conscious and greater awareness of anything else, because we are obviously so young and our brains aren't developed and we're such malleable creatures. And then those experiences are stored in our subconscious, whatever that may be. Some people think it's like an energy field outside the body. Some people think, who knows? And then we, as you said, we live that out. And, or one of the videos you said that when you engage or when you find yourself in a context that releases, or a similar context, all those chemicals come flooding back into you. And, you respond as if you're the 5-year-old that experienced those, that atrocity within reason. So you should, that would be a good, interesting reading for you to search up the waves, the frequency waves of child development and all that, because you obviously know a lot about it already. So that's good to augment your concept of it. And that's, yeah, and you're right. The, you know, when people say, throw around the idea that sex is meaningless and it can be casual, I would say, well, what's the worst crime that humans can commit against one another? And I'd say it's rape. And that is a good indication that sex can't be casual or meaning, because if you look on the flip side, it's able to cause that much damage and suffering and evil and malevolence, and completely ruin everything, then that's a good indicator that sex can't just be. Do you understand what I mean? Or is that a stupid idea?
Yeah.
So that's something that we're getting wrong in modern society. Understand. Yeah. Yes. What were we going to say? You say, I definitely understand. Are you going to say anything, or are you just agreeing?
I definitely understand that, you know, that if, well, I suppose it's hard. It's an interesting point, because it comes back to, you know, that there are certain experiences that we can share as humans, but they'll always depend entirely on how the human decides to use it I suppose that sex has an incredible capacity for the ultimate expression of, you know, love between two souls, two bodies, two minds.
Yeah.
But can also provide the greatest violation of the subconscious that, you know, we could possibly imagine, which is such an intense dichotomy that it, I suppose the one thing it reminds me of is how much power humans have to influence or affect change onto other humans. I think that we like to live in this idea that, you know, we are all independent beings, that we control our own fate, and that we will decide where we end up. And within reason, that's true. We can make very important decisions for ourselves, but we're not completely, you know, at some degree, we're at the mercy of the actions of the people around us. Like, I'm fortunate enough that my family decides every day to wake up and not try to take my life, you know, that kind of thing. But that's something I take for granted. But there is no guarantee that any human will continue to treat you with the same respect that you treat them. And I think that that reminds us to be very careful with our actions towards other people, because, you know, we can affect an enormous amount of change in the people around us in our simple actions.
Yeah, 100%. The complexity of, there's no limit to the complexity and the potential of other people, is there? And that's something you all have to contend with and have a level of trust in one another. And that's relates back to the religious thing and the notion of seeing others as something as valuable as ourselves, and something that's capable of manifesting the divine spark, which is a weird term, but it's you're right. Very good. Right. I think that is, actually, I've got one final question, which I need to ask. What was your breaking point in any, I guess, sector of life? Or maybe what was your breaking point to set up the Thinking Over project? Or do you understand what I mean? What was the point where you went, no more, or let's do this?
I've always had a desire to write and share a message, because I've always been an introspective person. Mm-hmm. But obviously being, I think I was 20 when I started. I initially started it as Thinking Over. It was a blog, and I had about 8 blogs. I got 8 posts through once a week, and then I decided that it was really going nowhere. And so rather than trying to force an outcome, I decided that I would just let it, you know, die and do its thing, and then I would, you know, revisit it if it ever came to pass. And lo and behold, 6 months later, I had reimagined it as a social media page where I shared video content. And as soon as I had that idea, it was sort of a pen drop moment. I was drawing little dots of things I wanted to do, like a podcast and a YouTube channel and writing here and selling something there. And I tied it under the banner of this project. And it was this pin drop moment for me where I realized the amount of change in my perspective that I'd experienced in the 6 months where I decided not to force an outcome was the reason I decided to continue it, because I thought, if this is how much change I've gone through in 6 months, I cannot fathom what this project will look like in an additional 6 months. Rather than me trying to force the 10-year vision right here, right now, in my 20, 21-year-old mind, if I just give it the time and the effort to grow, then it will grow. And that ties into my mental health journey as well. It's like, it is a gradual process where you can't fathom the heights that you'll reach, you know, in 10 years of dedicated compounded effort to be better, but that doesn't stop you from walking in that direction. And so that was really a beautiful realization for me to just keep pushing on with the project. Even if there was no definitive end goal in sight, I knew that I was putting effort into something that I thought would be valuable. And it's just got me. I'm 6 months down the line from that point, and I'm just thrilled at the thought of 6 more months.
Yeah, 100%. I think age 20 is a bit of a breaking point for a lot of people, actually. I think being an adult, in the modern era, being an adult should be pushed back to age 20, because we're all maturing, take longer to mature now. But 20, that's when I started doing my blog, but you're smarter than me and you reached the point that blogging, it's not 2005 anymore, and blogging, no one reads blogs anymore. Although it took me 2 years to work that out, whereas it took you 8 weeks. So well done. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Thomas. And thank you everyone for watching. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I've had an incredible time and I've loved listening and talking with you. Right. And I'll see you on the next one. Thank you guys for watching. Adios. That was a bad ending, but we'll go with it.
Beautiful. Thank you very much.